Yeah, look,
The
most of
medium.
people aren't
It's
doing
the
it, but there's
medium.
some skilled ones. It's the medium, exactly.
Or
There's skilled
there's
creators.
messages everywhere. And messages can be contained in anything, right?
Right.
Living information can exist anywhere. But when it's trapped in this medium of 30-second, 60-second, high-volume, instant access medium, it's programming the brain in a specific way, you know?
But
I
look
agree.
At
it's,
look
it's
at,
like
look
you,
at, look
you
at
can't get anything
Zen
more
right?
unlike Ulysses than TikTok. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I
but
mean,
everything's going to program in their specific way.
I
mean, we lose some stuff, we gain some
TikTok
stuff.
I think TikTok is Ulysses. And I don't understand how you don't see that.
I mean, yeah, I was thinking about Zen cones, right? Like the Zen cone is just like a phrase or something that leads to complete
right.
Satori, right? Like it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how long it is. Something is really.
Right. Oh. You can only see.
I think that
some words in a speech bubble.
Bruno was getting at with the art of memory and what print does in relation to the art of memory. And the over-reliance on print and the malleability of the brain and epigenetic mutations. No, this is not it's all unicorns and roses and like there's some nefarious shit out there.
Oh, for sure.
And it's
I
not
agree.
Fucking us up.
It could be
it's
worse.
Not fucking us up. It's fucking up people who are 10 years old and 9 years old and 12 years old and 15
right.
years old right now.
Right.
In a very specific window of the empire.
Absolutely.
I
totally agree with that.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I would just call it that this is their, it's what, let's go back to what Dick calls it, because every generation and every society is going to have a form of this astral determinism. And this is just their form. They're going to grow up with this TikTok brain and they're going to have to wake up from it. And then train.
No, I don't think that's true.
No.
Wait, go ahead. Say, what don't you think?
No, I don't
Will.
Think.
Bill, yeah.
I don't yeah. think that the astral determinism that you're painting on this mm-hmm. is like there's some eternal shit and eternal recurrence and some heroic journeys, but there's some temporal, local, very specific shit. That is unlike anything that human beings have been through in the last 200,000 years. You know what I mean?
Bill says, my cat died. He ran into a fucking car. there's suffering in the world, and you fuckers are just watching symbolism in movies.
No, it's Philip K. Dick saying, I wanted to write the truth in 1964, but I knew it would get me killed. And then I realized I can't write good books if I don't write the truth, but all I can do is write. So now I got to eat horse meat.
Well, hold on. Let me just read this.
Instead of, you know, taking the money and writing something soft and selling some books and getting a nice house and maybe making some movies. And you know what? Why would I? Life is fun. Life is to be enjoyed. No, he was battling the empire. He was like,
That interview that I sent Douglas, he mentions that the rational mind that kind of injected itself into his mind actually fired a whole bunch of publicists and stuff like that that were in his like management, like his handlers. So
mm-hmm.
he actually was gaining money. Like it even says it in Valis that he had more money in his bank account than he knew what to do with.
Yeah. Yep.
But that was
because do you know what that was? That was like having 10,000 in the bank.
Yeah. Valis readjusted his books, bro. Like
I don't know if you appreciate the choices that I believe Philip K. Dick made in his career. To be at the height of your powers as a writer, no, you can't write certain things because they're too true when you can't, like, you know what thought experiments are?
Yes.
You know, they talk about the great physicists, they would run a thought experiment.
A sci-fi novel.
Right. So the Bible is a thought experiment. Most sci-fi
sure.
novels are thought
Absolutely.
Experiments. The whole reason why you do a thought experiment is because physics and math allow you to simulate something, right, and then you interpret what the possible effects are, and then you look into your environment and you find those effects and you go, wait, so we ran a thought experiment about what could cause certain things and these effects would be the outcome. We look out into our world and we see the effects of the thought experiment. Maybe the things that we think are science fiction actually exist today because the effects are happening. This is The Invisible College by the UFO guy.
Yeah.
Who was in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, right? What's his fucking name? The French
guy. Jacques Vallée.
Yeah, Vallée.
Yeah.
So Philip K. Dick was saying, what if the Axis won? What if, you know, the Third Reich really never fell out of power? They just shapeshifted and they took over America. What would the effects be? And then he looked out in his world. He said, wait, the effects are here. And then he went deeper. And then all he could make sense of was that certain technologies exist and certain power structures exist because these effects are happening. There's no other source for these effects. And then he started to write about it, and the FBI started to get in, started fucking with him. Well, we're talking about 1960s CIA, FBI shit.
Right, the
only issue I have with any of this is, like, the FBI, although I have been investigated by the FBI twice, nobody's fucked with me. Like, does that mean I'm wrong? Does that mean that just because...
Well, I'm just saying this is the contention.
It means you're not paranoid enough.
Yeah. But this is the contention of Philip K. Dick's lived experience, was that, oh, shit, you know, I'm saying things people don't want me to say. Why is that? Because I think I'm insane for believing this. I think this is science fiction. People are treating it as if it's news, if it's journalism. Isn't that what gospel is? Good news, good journalism? Hey. But his gospel, his news was twisted. Mm-hmm. And he, oh, man, it's dark, man.
Well,
it's the whole Cat Williams story. Look at the whole career of Cat Williams. Remember what they paint him as? Oh, he's crazy. Yeah. He's getting arrested every time. And his whole excuse was, they know I'm a weed smoker. You can arrest me for weed anytime you want.
Right.
But they don't arrest Kevin Hart for weed. They don't arrest Eddie Murphy for weed. How come they arrest me for weed? I thought I was an entertainer. I sell out theaters across the country. How come they arrest me for weed? Because maybe Cat Williams' comedy and his voice and what he's doing in his community is something much different than what Richard Pryor was doing at the end of his career or Eddie Murphy was doing in Hollywood. Maybe Cat Williams was actually communicating and making political shifts with his comedy, which is exactly what he does. He's actually connected to a community and actually has a real voice like Philip K. Dick has, and he can move voting blocks through his words because he has the power of rhetoric. And when you saw him on Rogan, you saw a master of his craft, and you saw a really great guy who appreciates and acknowledges and recognizes someone with the power of rhetoric that Cat Williams has, you know? Cat Williams is like Giordano Bruno. That's the kind of figure that Giordano Bruno was.
I mean, yeah, impactfully, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, let me – sorry, I mean, look, I'm not disliking Cat Williams. I mean, I knew of him a little bit, but I don't know if – I mean, he certainly wasn't on my radar as much before that, those clips that went around with him and Rogan.
Well, the clips, first of all, started before Rogan. And at the beginning of 2024, he did an interview with
the woman.
Shannon Sharp.
Oh, the Shannon Sharp. Yeah, Shannon Sharp. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which blew up because he basically pinned like Kevin Hart as like fucking Illuminati and all kinds of stuff. He was a lot more in depth in the Shannon Sharp video than he was in the Rogan. The Rogan was mostly like biblical conspiracy theories, or ancient alien conspiracy theories. But Shannon Sharp was like more directly of like, there's an entity that is basically controlling Hollywood.
And he said in that interview, Joe Rogan won't have me on because I'm going to tell the truth or something like that. And then Joe Rogan had him on immediately. Can I just come back quickly to this idea of TikTok, because I want to, because even the Cat Williams stuff, like that was packaged in basically the TikTok format, these little clips. And I saw, you know, and that's how he spread. But I'm going to read Dick again. He says, the lower realm, or yin, form two of paramenides, is mechanical, driven by blind, efficient cause, deterministic, and without intelligence, since it emanates from a dead source. In ancient times, we termed it astral determinism. I would just say in modern times, we're not going to determine astral determinism. We might determine it the algorithm, right? The AI algorithm. That's what it sounds like to me.
No, exactly.
Mechanical, that's driven by blind, efficient cause, deterministic, without intelligence. And so, yes, we know TikTok is that. I just want to agree with you, Bill, completely. TikTok is that. And it puts people to sleep, for sure. You're just scrolling through it blindly. But I also think there is this ability to have like a Cat Williams that can kind of break through that somehow, and with truth, and like kind of shake the ground, like a Bruno of TikTok. That's what I hear you describing Cat Williams, is like the Giordano.
Well, the one component of the Shannon Sharp interview was that I think it had 40 million views on a 3-hour podcast. And so it was 40 million people had tuned into a 3-hour podcast where one guy basically just talked for 3 hours. Sharp didn't really say much. It was just Cat Williams basically saying, this is what it is.
Yeah.
That's what Lenny Bruce was like. He would get on stage and just talk about his life and about his actual confrontations with Empire. You know what I mean? With the lie. Remember, he said the lie. And that was Cat Williams on Channel Sharp. You just talked about the lie. I have survived living in the world with the lie. And everyone who heard that, no one was like, that's a man who's lying. Like, that's a man who's seen some shit. That's a man who knows some shit. He didn't stutter. You know what I mean? It was truly transcendent. And it's funny that he's not the dead cat. He's the live cat.
All right. Well, we are an hour and 12 minutes into this recording. Douglas might be asleep. I'm not sure.
No, I think he just went to bed.
He's gone. Yeah.
Douglas. Douglas just left it recording. Figured out. We left.
He left and just said, "You guys record, hang out." I'm gonna jam here in a little bit. I want to kind of wind down. I don't know if we have any kind of final thoughts. I mean, it might be interesting. I don't know, to share with. I think I just appreciate the conversation, guys, because of how alive this material is. And I'm really happy we went back into the actual text. And I was like reading these. Thanks, Sonora, for bringing like this 48, you know, looking at this actual final chapter, because this is powerful stuff. That's what not that we didn't realize that earlier on the 48 minute section. But I mean, this is actually like our real life. What was it that Kubrick says? This is your real life, like to the producer at whatever studio. I feel like that when reading Dick, it's like, this is the real life, man. This is the real question. Is like this, is it mechanical, driven by
blood? It's put forth in such a like almost a mundane way. There's like a simpleton advance to how, I mean, the things that he says in Valis are shockingly smart. They're shock. Like, they're shocking. You have to look it up and figure out what the fuck he's talking about. But it's presented in such a way that it doesn't take it seriously.
Yeah.
There's like a humor, like a simpleton humor to it. I would like to read what I just put into the chat real quick.
Okay.
This is from the Exegesis folder 3829. I reason now, if info can be transmitted to me, I must have some function. Memory storage. No, I suppose it's my writing. This certainly explains the axe and cipher material in tears. Good example of my function. I can transmit that way, and my writing, it's forever whipping messages back and forth like a brain. That's how it maintains its existence as a unitary entity. So seeing all the messages tells me more of the story. It fits the brain model. Written and auditory messages are its thoughts. The word Felix, juxtaposed with King, is a perfect example, not of code really, but a message evident, available only to parts of it. Set ground discrimination is involved, which is conscious parts must possess, which its conscious parts must possess. All that's needed is the Ajna chakra working. Boy, have I gotten close to figuring it out. How large do you suppose the brain is? Does it extend beyond the planet? It could. Yes, and much of our reality, or world, is superfluous. What is that?
Spurious. Spurious.
Spurious is spurious, i.e. directly imposed on our percept systems by the brain. I'm taking a wild guess. Not just by the black iron prison, but by the brain.
Wow.
Yeah. One thing I wanted, I think this other quote goes right to that. It's something I wanted to quote before about, he quotes in Valis, 1 John 3:1-2, which is, it's just pretty amazing. And the verse is, my dear people, we are already the children of God, but what we are to be in the future has not yet been revealed. All we know is that we shall be like him because we shall see him as he really is. And then he says, it can be argued that this is the most important statement in the New Testament. Certainly it is the most important, not generally known statement. We shall be like him. That means that man is isomorphic with God. We shall see him as he really is. There will occur a theophany, at least to some. Fat could base his credentials for his whole encounter on this passage. He could claim that his encounter with God consists of a fulfillment of the promise of 1 John 3:1-2. As Bible scholars indicate, it a sort of code which they can read off in an instant, as cryptic as it looks.
Wow.
You
know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. All who have this hope in him purify themselves just as he is pure. So the idea is you're kind of purifying so that you can witness something, that when it appears, the children of God, you know, that's a cult too.
Well, I'm reading Tolkien too, and he calls that if you get into his history of Middle Earth stuff, he calls it the children of Iluvatar, who is the one, right? And those are the elves and men. And he's always talking about to the end of the world, like to the end of the world, what happens. And that's what this verse is talking about. The end of the world, we become like God, because we already are like God.
So you can be what you project is the thing you want to be. Like man becomes God God becomes man so that man become God. It's like the ascent is the descent, or the descent is the ascent. So the fact that you go into the trash stratum means that you encompass the entirety of life. Like, you know what's the worst aspects of life, and you know what the best aspects of life are. Therefore, you're qualified to judge all life.
Yeah, yeah, you are helping with the process of transubstantiation, right? Which he talks about. Dick talks about the deepest meaning of that, right? Is like, Catholics know that the bread and wine is supposed to turn into the living body and blood of Christ. But the other thing is that, which they don't talk about as much, is that the priest giving the sacrament is actually turning into Christ at the Last Supper, and which means that the church is turning into the building of the Last Supper, and so on up until Dick's vision of the entire world being at that moment in Palestine, at that moment when Christ walked among us. You know, it's like that's what's happening at the at Mass, you know, every time.
Wow.
And so that's the deeper vision, is that we help we help change the world. The universe is in the process of turning into the Lord, you know, the entire universe, and we are helping to do that just by remembering it, like what Bill said.
But I feel like there's so many things that have been forgotten. I mean, as far as like, and I feel like that's kind of like the way that Valis leaves you. Like, horse liver fat is still out there somewhere, right? Horse liver fat is still traveling from China to India, trying to piece together all of these like lost, forgotten Easter eggs on where the Savior has and has not been throughout history, that have like obviously been forgotten. All of, and then that's what's up with all the links. Like, he's just basically shoving these like futuristic links down your throats in like a 1978 style conversation. The thing that I am upset about the most in Valis is that I don't have that group of friends to talk to.
Well, you know, except here.
Not you do.
Here is the closest we get, right? But you, well, he has those every day. Like, those people are calling him up. Those people, if he's having a bad day, they know he's crazy. They know he has like a split personality, and yet they're still there every day.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Entertaining his thoughts.
Yeah, they all know the deepest fucked up part of everyone else's whole psyche, right? And then they accept it. With love, right? With compassion, and he's always stressing that point.
I think that's right. It. I gotta go.
Yep.
It's like midnight.
All right.
This was pretty amazing that this was 50 years. So
I know, I did. That blew my mind when I came.
Didn't even think of that.
But just one more question, though, is like, wow, that's a huge one. But I wanted to ask SJ about this, because I think you follow this through the astrology.
Yep.
About the return of the, like, in Valis, right? Like, it's obvious that at that time in 1974, Dick was terrified that Nixon was turning the U.S. into a complete totalitarian empire. And then that was stopped by Zebra, by Valis or whatever, right? But it really feels like we're on the cusp of that again, you know, on the cusp of that. You know, and I just wanted to hear what do the stars say about that?
Well, it's a huge topic. We're on the cusp of something that hasn't happened. Well, let me just try to run through quickly a few things. I'll just say this so high level, the astrological details I'm going to leave behind. But basically, I think it was 1904 when the thing was unleashed again, based on these astrological alignments having to do with what we call planetary rulership and the seven traditional planets. You get these, an event that took place in 33 CE, mm-hmm. and it doesn't similarly repeat until 1904. And that was the year Crowley got the download. And so I kind of think that when you look at like occultism in the West, Crowley is, there's always links all the way back, but, you know, Crowley, there's something with Crowley that happens, you know, influences the Beatles, influences Bowie, and now we're to Dick pretty quickly. I mean, that's a really short span of time. So there's that conversation, which I'll leave for another time. But that, you know, and just to summarize that, we astrologically, something was really opened up in the 20th century, right at the beginning. The Theosophists knew about it. They talked about it. They were focused on like 1890s, 1880s, 1890s. But that period kicked humanity. I mean, just think about the 19th and 18th century, horseback, horse buggy, the same tech for thousands of years. And right as the 20th century emerges with electricity, it's a whole, these accelerations have happened as a result. But I would just say this, the other thing is that, yeah, we have a special alignment of outer planets that is very, very rare coming in 2026. And the debates right now in the astrological community are, will this be a kind of New Jerusalem moment? And a lot of astrologers have predicted that because of how elegant these alignments are between Pluto, Uranus, Neptune, and Saturn and Jupiter. Extremely elegant.
What are the alignments? Like what?
So let me just get it's July 2026. People can just type it in. And I've called it the basket in some of the work I've done online. But effectively, it is, I'll just say it, Pluto is in Aquarius, 4 degrees, 34 degree minutes. Neptune in Aries, 4 degrees, 24 degree minutes. This is on the date, 15 July 2026. Uranus in Gemini, 4 degrees, 22 degree minutes. And then you'll have Jupiter in Leo, 3 degrees, 14 degree minutes. But basically, every outer planet will be in the fifth degree of only masculine signs. And so what it, and when I say outer planet, I mean true, like modern outer planet, Neptune, right, Pluto, right, right. And Uranus. Right. But you add Jupiter and Saturn, and they're also in this. But and it gets more complicated. But basically, it's a trine, which is a free-flowing supportive energy between Pluto and Aquarius and Uranus and Gemini. And an exact applying trine, and then a sextile, which is also known as a free-flowing supportive aspect between Neptune and Aries. And Neptune and Aries will make a sextile to Uranus and Gemini and a sextile to Pluto and Aquarius. So it's a configuration called a minor grand trine. And basically, you know, just to summarize my delineation, I think we're on the cusp of this these tech breakthroughs that are going to basically, you know, revolutionize everything, even if there is a little bit of a short war here. You know, AI, and that's what we have now, LLM technology, it's already revolutionizing things because people are using it to extend their creativity. Like I've used it to code. I'm not a coder, but I've coded so much stuff using it. I didn't even know what I've done. I couldn't even tell you. You know, I know I've used PHP and JavaScript a lot, but I don't know anything beyond that. I know how to use LLM to create stuff. But I mean, this is going to happen across sectors. And so I think we're on the cusp of some real creative golden age stuff emerging that if you go with a positive scenario, there's really like a threshold of like, it's like Ray Kurzweil to come back to Joe Rogan, was just on Joe Rogan. You can go listen to that. I saw clips of it to go back to TikTok, the little TikTok versions of it. But, you know, we're going to have some major tech advancements that we're on the cusp of. That's running simultaneous with the idea of Revolutionary War, Civil War, World War II as part of the same cycle for America. And so, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. There's these real mixed testimony about this kind of powerful collective moment we're about to be pulled through. And I think it'll contain all of it, frankly. I mean, it'll probably be like wars or versions of civil wars and the worst black eyed prison shit at the same time, like the most profound technological utopias all in the same kind of moment. You might say it this way, that this is the point at the end of time, like that McKenna, like I feel like there's another little version of that we're about to come through. And I hope we all survive. I hope to talk to you on the other end of it. You know, but like, I think by 2032, 2033, it'll certainly be over. So that's the long and short of it.
To take it back to the 16th century, and to take it back to the Bohemian Empire in Germany, the Winter King, right? Mm-hmm. That McKenna talks about, and that there was this push to bring Europe into the glories of Western Hermeticism, right? To say, to enlighten, to really bring people out of the heliocentric or the geocentric, you know, into the heliocentric, into the multiverse. They were ready to initiate this because they had these pockets of communities that were flourishing. And they said, well, why can't everyone do this, right? I think what we're going to find going forward is either we are going to be in the world of Bitcoin or we are going to remain in the world of the dollar. And if we remain in the world of the dollar, everyone will have dollars, but no one will have Bitcoin. And no one really knows just how black iron prison that really is, except for a few of us who have run the thought experiment and have seen the possibilities on the other side of the dollar. And that's, I think, the best way to describe this sort of cusp that we're on, is that we have everything that should make a post-dollar world possible, right?
Yep.
It would just take the right voice and the right language and the right communication to just make sure we don't fuck this up. But what if the reason why that voice is not being communicated is because there's an active agency trying to disrupt that message? And that in 30 years, all of us will be paying for groceries with dollars and cents. And everyone will say, well, how could that be such a bad thing? Everyone has money. Right? And most people won't know that we're still in the empire never ended. They'll think, well, no, the empire, what do you mean? Everyone has money. Everyone's paying, everyone has dollars and coins.
I mean, there's the, I don't know, Bitcoin is a, it could be a trap as well, or at least turned into a trap, you know.
I don't think it is.
Everything gets on the blockchain, you know, it's like a, well, I think yes. Bitcoin itself is maybe okay, but it's kind of an advertisement for the central bank digital currencies, right? Like a
it's decentralizing currency, right? And currency is the motion of water, right?
But if it's
centralized currency means somebody owns the water.
But if it's all
decentralized,
it's all,
currency means we're all in the ocean.
I understand that point, but it's like if it's all transferable, if it's all transferable to dollars, which it is now, you know, then the person who has the most dollars has the most Bitcoin, you know. It's like and so nothing changes, right?
Listen, these are big debates, guys. I'm gonna jam out, I think, because I just have to go. Let's see, where am I now? I'm at 7. 5:10 in the morning, and I'm going to try to get some Z's here. but it's great to talk to y'all, and I hope that gives you a little bit, Snore, of what we're looking at. And I think
that's
very
great.
Elegant, Bill. I think that's right. It's a metaphor. Like, just look at Bitcoin as a metaphor of like decentralized versus the central bank digital currency. That's, I think, what you're describing, unleashing the power of the people versus kind of these containers of hierarchical dominance. With all the tech stuff coming online. So anyhow, I'm going to jam. You guys are going
to
hang out.
You've been listening to 42 Minutes, a production of Syncbook Radio and the syncbook.com. I don't remember the rest of it, but we can all say goodnight to Douglas Bowles.
Night, Douglas Bowles.
Night, Doug.
Night, Douglas Bowles. Go smoke Bowles.
Gentlemen.
Good night, guys.
See you guys.
All right, guys.
Great.
There's a star now waiting in the sky. He likes to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a star now waiting in the sky. He told us not to blow it, but he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children lose it. Let the children lose it.
The subject of this speech is a topic which has been discovered recently and which may not exist at all. I may be talking about something that does not exist, Therefore, I'm free to say everything or nothing. I can hardly make an error if there is no such thing as orthogonal time. Orthogonal or right angle time is the topic of my speech. We are accustomed to supposing that all change takes place along the linear time axis from past to present to future. The present is an accrual of the past and is different from it. The future will accrue from the present on and be different yet. That an orthogonal or right angle time axis could exist, a lateral domain in which change takes place, processes occurring sideways in reality, so to speak, this is almost impossible to imagine. How would we perceive such lateral changes? What would we experience? What clues, if we are trying to test out this bizarre theory, should we be on the alert for? In other words, how can change take place outside of linear time at all, in any sense, to any degree? Let me present you with a metaphor. Let us say that there exists this very rich patron of the arts. Every day on the wall of his living room above his fireplace, his servants hang a new picture, each day a different masterpiece, day after day, month after month. Each day the used one is removed and replaced by a different and new one. I shall call this process change along the linear axis. But now let us suppose the servants temporarily running out of new replacement pictures. What shall they do in the meantime? They can't just leave the present one hanging. Their employer has decreed that perpetual replacement, that is to say, changing the pictures, is to take place. So they neither allow the current one to remain, nor do they replace it with a new one. Instead, they do a very clever thing. When their employer is not looking, the servants cunningly alter the picture already on the wall. They paint out a tree here, they paint in a little girl there, they add this, they obliterate that, they make the same painting different, and in a sense new, but as I'm sure you can see, not new in the sense of replacing it. The employer enters his living room after dinner, seats himself facing the fireplace, and contemplates what should be, according to his expectations, the new picture. What does he see? It certainly isn't what he saw previously, but also it isn't somehow, and here we must become very sympathetic with this perhaps somewhat stupid man, because we can virtually see his brain circuits striving to understand. His brain circuits are saying, yes, it is a new picture, it is not the same one as yesterday. But also it is the same one, I think. I feel on a very deep intuitive basis, I feel that somehow I've seen it before. I seem to remember a tree, though, and there is no tree. Now, perhaps if we extrapolate from this man's perceptual mentational confusion to the theoretical point I was making about lateral change, you can get a better idea of what I mean. I mean, perhaps you can, to at least a degree, see that although what I'm talking about may not exist, my concept may be fictional, it could exist. It is not intellectually self-contradictory. Contemplating this possibility of a lateral arrangement of worlds, a plurality of overlapping Earths along whose linking axis a person can somehow move, can travel in a mysterious way from worst to fair to good to excellent, contemplating this in theological terms, perhaps we could say that herewith we suddenly decipher the elliptical utterances which Christ expressed regarding the kingdom of God, specifically where it is located. He seems to have given contradictory and puzzling answers, but suppose, just suppose for an instant, that the cause of the perplexity lay not in any desire on his part to baffle or to hide, but in the inadequacy of the question. My kingdom is not of this world, he is reported to have said. The kingdom is within you, or possibly it is among you. I put before you now the notion, which I personally find exciting, that he may have had in mind that which I speak of as the lateral axis of overlapping realms, which contain among them a spectrum of aspects ranging from the unspeakably malignant to the beautiful. And Christ was saying over and over again that there really are many objective realms somehow related and somehow bridgeable by living, not dead men, and that the most wondrous of these worlds was a just kingdom. in which either he himself or God himself or both of them ruled. And he did not merely speak of a variety of ways of subjectively viewing one world. The kingdom was and is an actual different place at the opposite end of continua, starting with slavery and utter pain. It was his mission to teach his disciples the secret of crossing along this orthogonal path. He did not merely report what lay there. He taught the method of getting there. But, tragically, the secret was lost. The enemy, the Roman authority, crushed it, and so we do not have it. But perhaps we can re-find it, since we know that such a secret exists. Kingdom is ever to be established here on earth, or whether it is a place or state we go to after death. I'm sure I don't have to tell you that this issue has been a fundamental one and an unresolved one throughout the history of Christianity. Christ and St. Paul both seem to say emphatically that an actual breaking through into time, that is specifically what they say, a breaking through into time, into our world, by the host of God, will unexpectedly occur. Thereupon, after some exciting drama, a thousand-year paradise, a rightful kingdom will be established, at least for those who have done their homework and chores and generally paid attention, have not gone to sleep, as one parable puts it. We are enjoined repeatedly in the New Testament to be vigilant, that for the Christian it is always day. There is always light by which he can see this event when it comes. See this event. Does that imply that many persons who are somehow asleep or blind or not vigilant, they will not see it even though it occurs? Consider the significance which can be assigned to these notions. The kingdom will come here unexpectedly. This is always stressed. The rightful faithful shall see it, because for them it is always daytime. But for the others, what seems expressed here is the paradoxical but enthralling thought that, and hear this and ponder, the kingdom, were it established here, would not be visible to those outside it. I offer the idea that in more modern terms, what is meant that some of us will travel laterally to that better world and some will not. They will remain stuck along the lateral axis, which means that for them the kingdom did not come, not in their alternative world. And yet, meantime, it did come in ours. So it comes, and yet it does not come. Amazing. If you have followed my conjectures about the overlapping of these alternate worlds, and you sense as I do the possibility that if there are 3 or 4 or 2, there may be 30 or 3,000 of them, and that some of us live in this one, others of us in another one, others in others, and that events on one track cannot be perceived by persons not in that track, well, let me say what I want to say and be done with it. I think I once experienced a track in which the Savior returned, but I experienced it just briefly. I am not there now. I am not sure I ever was. Certainly I may never be again. I grieve for that loss, but loss it is. Somehow I moved laterally, but then fell back, and then it was gone. A vanished mountain and a stream, the sound of bells, and all gone now for me, entirely gone. I, in my stories and novels, often write about counterfeit worlds, semi-real worlds, as well as deranged private worlds, inhabited often by just one person, while meantime the other characters either remain in their own worlds throughout or are somehow drawn into one of the peculiar ones. This theme occurs in the corpus of my 27 years of writing. At no time did I have a theoretical or conscious explanation for my preoccupation with these pluriform pseudo-worlds, but now I think I understand. What I was sensing was the manifold of partially actualized realities lying tangent to what evidently is the most actualized one, the one which the majority of us, by consensus gentium, agree on. Although originally I presumed that the differences between these worlds was caused entirely by the subjectivity of the various human viewpoints, it did not take me long to open the question as to whether it might not be more than that, that in fact plural realities did exist superimposed onto one another like so many film transparencies. What I still do not grasp, however, is how one reality out of the many becomes actualized in contradistinction to the others. Perhaps none does. Or perhaps, again, it hangs on an agreement in viewpoint by a sufficiency of people. More likely, the matrix world, the one with the true core of being, is determined by the programmer. He or it articulates, prints out, so to speak, the matrix choice and fuses it with actual substance. The core or essence of reality, that which receives or attains it, and to what degree, that is within the purview of the programmer. This selection and reselection is part of general creativity, of world building, which seems to be it or his task. A problem, perhaps, which he or it is running, which is to say, in the process of solving, as a computer would. Variables along the linear time axis of our universe, thereby generating branched off lateral worlds. I have the impression that the metaphor of the chessboard is especially useful in evaluating how this can be done. In fact, must be. Across from the programmer-reprogrammer sits a counter entity, whom Joseph Campbell calls the dark counterplayer. God, the programmer-reprogrammer, is not making his moves of improvement against inert matter. He is dealing with a cunning opponent. Let us say that on the game board, our universe in space-time, the dark counterplayer makes a move. He sets up a reality situation of immutable cause and effect. But the programmer-reprogrammer has already laid down his response. It has already happened, these moves on his part. The printout, which we undergo as historic events, passes through stages of a dialectical interaction, thesis and antithesis, as the forces of the two players mingle. Evidently, some syntheses fall to the dark counterplayer, and yet they do not, by virtue of the fact that in advance, our great advocate selected variables, the alternation of which brings final victory to him. In winning each sequence in turn, he claims some of us, we who participate in the sequence. This is why, instinctively, people pray, Libera me Domine, which decodes to mean, extricate me, programmer, as you achieve one victory after another. Include me in that triumph. Move me along the lateral axis so that I am not left out. Sense as being left out means nothing other than remaining under the jurisdiction of or falling prey to the malignant power. But that malignant power, for all its guile, has already lost even as it wins. For in some way, the counterplayer is blind, and so the programmer-reprogrammer possesses an advantage. I submit to you that such alterations, the creation or selection of such so-called alternative presence, is continually taking place. The very fact that we can conceptually deal with this notion, that is, entertain it as an idea, is the first step in discerning such processes themselves. But I doubt if we will ever be able in any real fashion to demonstrate, to scientifically prove, that such lateral change processes do occur. Probably all we would have to go on would be vestiges of memory, fleeting impressions, dreams, nebulous intuitions that somehow things had been different in some way, and not long ago, but now. We might reflexively reach for a light switch in the bathroom, only to discover that it was, always had been, in another place entirely. We might reach for the air vent in our car, where there was no air vent, a reflex left over from a previous present, still active at a subcortical level. We might dream of people and places we had never seen as vividly as if we had seen them and actually known them. But we would not know what to make of this, assuming we took time to ponder it at all. One very pronounced impression would probably occur to us, to many of us, again and again, and always without explanation, the acute, absolute sensation that we had done once before what we were just about to do now, that we, so to speak, lived in a particular moment or situation previously. But in what sense could it be called previously, since only the present, not the past, was evidently involved? We would have the overwhelming impression that we were reliving the present deja vu. Perhaps in precisely the same way, hearing the same words, saying the same words, I submit that these impressions are valid and significant. And I will even say this, such an impression is a clue that at some past time point, a variable was changed, reprogrammed as it were, and that because of this, an alternative world branched off, became actualized instead of the prior one, and that in fact, in literal fact, we are once more living this particular segment of linear time. A breaching, a tinkering, a change had been made, but not in our present, had been made in our past. Evidently, such an alteration would have a peculiar effect on those persons involved. They would, so to speak, be moved back one square or several squares on the board game, which constitutes our reality. Conceivably, this could happen any number of times, affecting any number of people, as alternative variables were reprogrammed. We would have to live out each reprogramming along the subsequent linear time axis, but to the programmer, whom we call God, to him the results of the programming would be apparent once. We are within time, and he is not. I wish to add lib. We are living in a computer-programmed reality, and the only clue we have to it is when some variable is changed and some alteration in our reality occurs. This, too, might account for the sensation people get of having lived past lives. They may well have, but not in the past. Previous lives, rather, in the present. In perhaps an unending, repeated and repeated present, like a great clock dial in which grand clock hands sweep out the same circumference forever, with all of us carried along unknowingly, yet dimly suspecting. Since at the resolution of every encounter of thesis and antithesis between the dark counterplayer and the divine programmer, a new synthesis is struck off, and since it is possible that each time this happens, a lateral world may be generated, and since I conceive that each synthesis or resolution is in some degree a victory by the programmer, each struck off world in sequence must be an improvement upon not just the prior one, but an improvement upon all the latent or merely possible outcomes. It is a better world, but in no sense perfect, which is to say final. It is merely an improved stage within a process. What I envision clearly is that the programmer is perpetually using the antecedent universe as a gigantic stockpile for each new synthesis, the antecedent universe then possessing the aspect of chaos, or anomie, in relation to an emerging new cosmos. Therefore, the endless process of sequential struck-off alternate worlds emerging and being infused with actualization is negentropic in some way that we cannot see. What we need at this point is to locate, to bring forth as evidence, someone who has managed somehow, it doesn't matter how, to retain memories of a different present, latent alternate world impressions, different in some significant way from this, the one which is at this stage actualized. According to my theoretical view, it would almost certainly be memories of a worse world than this. For it is not reasonable that God, the programmer and reprogrammer, would substitute a worse world in terms of freedom or beauty or love or order or healthiness by any standard which we know. When a mechanic works on your malfunctioning car, he does not damage it further. When a writer creates a second draft of a novel, he does not debase it further, but strives to improve it. I suppose it could be argued in a strictly theoretical way that God might be evil or insane and would in fact substitute a worse world for a better one. But frankly, I cannot take that idea seriously. Let us pass that over. So let us ask, does any one of us remember in any dim fashion a worse Earth circa 1977 than this? Have our young men seen visions and our old men dreamed dreams? Nightmare dreams specifically about a world of enslavement and evil, of prisons and jailers and ubiquitous police. I have. I wrote out these dreams in novel after novel, story after story. To name two in which this prior ugly present obtained most clearly, I cite The Man in the High Castle and my 1974 novel about the U.S. as a police state, called Flow My Tears, the Policeman Said. I'm going to be very candid with you. I wrote both novels based on fragmentary residual memories of such a horrid slave state world. Or perhaps the term world is the wrong one and I should say United States, since in both novels I was writing about my own country. I can even tell you what caused me to remember. In late February of 1974, I was given sodium pentothal for the extraction of impacted wisdom teeth. Later that day, back home again, but still deeply under the influence of the sodium pentothal, I had a short, acute flash of recovered memory. In one instant, I caught it all, but immediately rejected it. Rejected it, however, with the realization that what I had retrieved in the way of varied memories was authentic. Then, in mid-March, a month later, the total body of memories, intact and entire, began to return. You are free to believe me or to disbelieve, but please take my word on it that I am not joking. This is very serious, a matter of importance. I am sure that at the very least you will agree that for me even to claim this is in itself amazing. People claim to remember past lives. I claim to remember a different, very different present life. I know of no one who has ever made this claim before, but I rather suspect that my experience is not unique. What perhaps is unique is the fact that I am willing to talk about it. If you have followed me this far, I would like you to be kind enough to go a little further with me. I would like to share with you something I knew that is retrieved along with the blocked off memories. In March of 1974, the reprogrammed variables tinkered with back at some earlier date, probably in the late 40s, in March of 1974, the payoff, the results of at least one and possibly more of the reprogrammed variables lying along the linear timeline of our past set in. What happened between March and August of 1974 was the result of at least one reprogrammed variable laid down perhaps 30 years before, setting into motion a thread of change which culminated in what I am sure you will admit was a spectacularly important and unique historical event, the forced removal from office of a president of the United States, Richard Nixon, as well as all those associated with him. In the alternative world which I remembered, the civil rights movements, the anti-war movements of the 60s had failed, and evidently, in the mid-70s, Nixon was not removed from power. That which deposed him, if anything indeed existed that did oppose him or could oppose him, was inadequate. Therefore, one or more factors tending toward that destruction of the entrenched tyrannical power had retroactively to us come to be introduced. The scales, 30 years later, in 19, had been 2,000 years ago at its inception. It was regarded as subversive and revolutionary, and let me add, this appraisal by the police authorities was correct. It took me almost 2 weeks after the return of my memories of my life in Track A to rid myself of the overpowering impression that all references to Christ, all sacerdotal acts, had to be veiled in absolute secrecy. But historically, this fits the pattern of a fascist takeover, especially those along Nazi lines. I also would like to tell you, if you have followed me this far, to accept my statement about my other memories under the sodium pentothal which returned. That world was a prison. It was dreadful. We overthrew it, just as we overthrew the Nixon tyranny. But it was far more cruel, incredibly so, and there was a great battle and loss of life. It was in February of 1974 that my blocked-off memories of Track A returned, and it was in February of 1974 that my novel, Flow My Tears, the Policeman Said, was released finally after two years delay. It was almost as if the release of the novel, which had been delayed so long, meant that in a certain sense it was all right for me to remember. That is to remember that the book was not fiction. The book was based on subliminal memories which I had of such a world. But perhaps until the book was actually released, it was better that I did not remember. Why that would be, I do not know. But I have the impression that the memories were not to come to the surface until the material had been published very sincerely on the author's part, as what he believed to be fiction. Perhaps had I known, I would have been too frightened to write the novel. As it was, I was very frightened anyway. There was something about the novel that frightened me a great deal. Or perhaps I would have just shot off my mouth and told everybody and somehow interfered with the effectiveness of that book and such other books of mine as Man in the High Castle, which were also based on residual memories. The effectiveness of those novels might have been impaired. I do not even claim there was an intended effectiveness. Perhaps there was none at all. But if there was one, and I repeat the word if emphatically, it was almost certainly to stir subliminal memories in readers back to dim life. Not a conscious life, not an entering consciousness as in my own case, but to recall to them on a deep and profound, albeit unconscious level, what a police tyranny is like and how vital it is now or then, at any time, along any time track in any world, to defeat it. In March of 1974, the really crucial moves to depose Nixon were beginning. In August, 5 months later, they proved successful. It seems to me that in many ways, ideas have a life of their own. They appear to seize on people and make use of them. The idea which seized me 27 years ago and never let go of me is this. Any society in which people meddle in other people's business is not a good society, and a state in which the government, quote, knows more about you than you know about yourself, as it is expressed in my novel Flow My Tears, the policeman said, is a state which must be overthrown. It may be a theocracy, a fascist corporate state, or reactionary monopolistic capitalism, or centralistic socialism. That aspect does not matter. And I am saying not merely it can happen here, meaning the United States, but rather it did happen here, meaning the United States. I remember I was one of the secret Christians who fought it and at least to some extent helped overthrow it. And I am very proud of that, proud of myself in Time Track A. When I use the word Christian there, I do not mean Christians as they are now. I mean Christians as they were, say, 2,000 years ago, enemies of a powerful empire. When I saw Star Wars this morning, I thought to myself, deja vu. There is, unfortunately, for me, a somber intimation which accompanies my pride in the work that I did in that alternate Earth. I think that in that previous world, I did not live past March of 1974. In this track here, which I will call Track B, we fought a much lighter tyranny, a far stupider one. Or perhaps we had assistance. The anterior reprogramming of one or more historical variables came to our rescue. Sometimes I think, and this is of course pure speculation, a happy fantasy of my soul, that because of what we accomplished there, or anyhow attempted to and very bravely, we who were directly involved were allowed to live on here, past the terminal point which brought us down in that other worse world. It is a sort of miraculous kindness. This gracious gift serves to delineate for us, for me at least, some aspects of the programming. It causes me to comprehend him after a fashion. I think we cannot know what he is, but we can experience his functioning, and so can ask, what does he resemble? Not what is he, but rather what is he like? First and foremost, he controls the objects, processes, and events in our space-time world. This is, for us, the primary aspect, although intrinsically he may possess aspects of greater magnitude but of less applicability to us. I have spoken of myself as a reprogrammed variable, and I have spoken of him as the programmer and reprogrammer. During a short period of time in March of 1974, at the moment in which I was resynthesized, I was aware perceptually, which is to say aware in an external way, of his presence. At that time, I had no idea what I was seeing. It resembled nothing that I had ever heard described. It resembled plasmic energy. It had colors. It moved fast. It collected and then dispersed. But what it was, what he was, I am not sure even now. Except I can tell you that he had simulated normal objects and their processes so as to copy them and in such an artful way as to make himself invisible within them. As the Vedantists put it, he is the fire within the flint, the razor within the razor case. Later research showed me that in terms of group cultural experience, the name Brahman has been given to this omnipresent, immanent entity. One thing I really want you to know, I am aware that the claims I am making, claims of having retrieved buried memories of an alternate present and to have perceived the agency responsible for arranging that alternation, these claims can neither be proved nor can they be even made to sound rational in the usual sense of the word. It has taken me over 3 years to reach the point where I am willing to tell anyone but my closest friends about my experience beginning back at the vernal equinox of 1974. One of the reasons motivating me to speak about it publicly at last, to openly make this claim, is a recent encounter I have undergone, which, by the way, bears a strange resemblance to Hawthorne Abendson's experience in my novel, The Man in the High Castle, with the woman Juliana Frink. Juliana read Abendson's book about a world in which Germany and Japan and Italy... Now, this is a little difficult if you haven't read the book, but he wrote a novel in which Germany, Italy, and Japan lost World War II, and he was living in a world in which they had won World War II. Juliana read Abendson's book about a world in which the Axis lost, and she felt she should tell him what she comprehended about the book. In other words, that his novel was true. Now, this final scene in Man in the High Castle has been the source for a similar scene in my later story, Faith of Our Fathers, where the girl Tanya Lee shows up and acquaints the protagonist with the actual reality situation, which is to say that much of his world is delusional and purposefully so. In other words, it's a common theme in my writing that a dark-haired girl shows up at the door of the protagonist and tells him that his world is delusional, that there's something false about it. Now, in Man in the High Castle, the situation is ironically reversed. The girl that comes to the door tells an author that his book of fiction is true. For several years, I have had the feeling, a growing feeling, that one day a woman who would be a complete stranger to me would contact me and tell me that she had some information to impart to me, and then she would appear at my door, just as Juliana appeared at Hawthorne Abendson's door, and that forthwith, in the gravest possible way, she would tell me exactly what Juliana told Abendson, and that is that my book, like his, was in a certain real, literal, and physical sense, not fiction, but the truth. Well, this did finally happen to me. I even knew that her hair would be black. I had an actual complete sense of what she would look like and what she would say. Door. And I'm speaking of a woman who had systematically read every single novel of mine, which is more than 30 novels, as well as many of my stories. She did appear. She was a total stranger, and she did inform me of this fact, that some of my fictional works were in a literal sense true. Now, I had posited in 1974, when my memories of this alternate world came back, that if these memories were authentic, that it was only a matter of time before a contact, a cautious, guarded probing by someone would occur, initiated by a person who had read my books and for one reason or another deduced the actual situation. I mean, knew what the significant information was which the books and stories carried. Now, this woman knew from my novels and stories which world I had experienced, which of the many. What she could not determine until I told her was that in February of 1975, I had passed across into a third alternative present, a third one, Track C, we will call it. And this was a garden or park of peace and beauty, a world superior to ours, rising into existence. To her, of three rather than two worlds. The black iron prison world, which had been our intermediate world in which oppression and war exist but have to a great degree been cast down, and then a third alternative world, which someday, when the correct variables in our past have been reprogrammed, will materialize as a superimposition onto this one, and within which, as we awaken to it, we shall suppose that we had always lived there. The memory of this intermediate one, like that of the black iron prison world, eradicated mercifully from our memories. The best that I can really do at this point, after having had these experiences and written these novels, is to play the role of prophet, of ancient prophets and such oracles as the Sibyl at Delphi, and to talk of a wonderful garden world, much like that which once our ancestors are said to have inhabited. In fact, I sometimes imagine it to be exactly that same world restored, as if a false trajectory of our world will eventually be fully corrected, and once more we will be where once, many thousands of years ago, we lived and were happy. During the brief time I walked about in that garden world, I had the strong impression that it was our legitimate home, which somehow we had lost. The time I spent there was short, about 6 hours of real elapsed time, but I remember it well. In the novel I wrote with Roger Zelazny, Deus Iri, I describe it toward the end, at the point where the curse is lifted from the world by the death. What's amazing to me about this park-like world, this Track C, was the non-Christian elements forming the basis of it. It was not what my Christian training had prepared me for at all. Even when it began to phase out, I still saw sky, I saw land and dark blue smooth water, and standing by the edge of the water, a beautiful nude woman whom I recognized as Aphrodite. At that point, this other better world had diminished to a mere landscape beyond a golden rectangle doorway. The outline of the doorway pulsed with laser-like light, and it all grew smaller and was at last gone from sight. The three to five doorway, devouring itself into nothingness, sealing off what lay beyond. I have not seen it since, but I had the firm impression that this was the next world, not of the Christians, but the Arcady of the Greco-Roman world, something older and more beautiful than that which my own religion can conjure up as a lure to keep us in a state of dutiful morality and faith. What I saw was very old and very lovely. Sky, sea, land, and the beautiful woman, and then nothing, for the door had shut, and I was closed off back here. It was with a bitter sense of loss that I saw her go, really, since it all constellated about her.
Taxi driver, be my shrink for the hour, leave the meter running. It's rush hour, so take the streets if you want them. Just outrun the demons, could you? He said, Allahu Akbar, I told him don't curse me. Boy, you need prayer, I guess it couldn't hurt me. If it brings me to my knees, it's a bad religion. Ooh, the sun is quite in love. To me, it's nothing but when my God's in cyanide and much styrofoam cup. I can never make a driver, I swear I've got three lives balanced on my head like stick knives. I can't tell you the truth about my disguise. I can't trust no one. And you say, Allahu Akbar. I told him, don't curse me. Well, boy, you need prayer. I guess they couldn't hurt me. If it brings me to my knees, it's a bad religion. Love to me is nothing but a one-man cult. In cyanide, my styrofoam cup. I can never make them love me. Never make them love me. No, no. Ah, it's a bad religion to be in love. Someone who can never love you. Oh, 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 only bad religion could have me feeling the way I.